Chapter 48. From his perch on a wooded knoll, Davon spied on the Cretesian army spreading across the wooded hills at evening in search of rest and food. Like a blight of insects, they seemed, a mighty plague scrabbling over the land. Their pants were the off-white of eggshells, coats a dull grey. Sporadic fires sprang to life as the sun dipped behind the treetops to the west, the evening glow casting a warm light on the sparse, puffy clouds. To his sensitive, sabre-cat nostrils, the stench of the army was like sticking his nose into the armpit of an unwashed beggar. His desperate purpose had propelled him northward at a blistering pace. With ears pinned back and paws barely touching the ground, he had streaked like a mighty bullet shot from Belshire toward its foes. He had kept to the road as much as possible for speed, but turned aside frequently to avoid the frantic stream of human traffic. Refugees from all the northern duchies fled hastily southward toward the capital to escape the grasp of the advancing Cretesians. Davon had rejoiced to catch glimpses of rifles leaning on many of the refugees' shoulders. Belshire needed as many guns as it could get. He had stopped to rest and watch on a high tree-covered hill not far from where the Cretesians had stopped to camp for the evening. Watching the Cretesian horde fan out below him, he knew the paltry reinforcements provided by the influx of refugees would hardly bolster the defences enough to add one more day to Belshire's freedom. There were simply too many Cretesian soldiers. The enemy army would overrun the city in less than 4 days, and even that estimate required him to admit some unwarranted optimism into his calculations. The Cretesians would pour into Belshire, kill and subdue the resistance, and have plenty of time to fortify before the main body of Belshire's armies returned from the south. Davon transformed back into the form of a man and sat, putting his back to a barkless pine burned bare by a lightning strike. Since the reigniting of the eternal flame, he had only seen 2 shapes in wood for him to carve. While camping the night before, a piece of hickory deadfall had shown him a new snowfinch for Key and a rose pendant for Ariane. These he had carved and finished with his usual speed and finesse before he had fallen asleep that night. And now, there to his left, superimposed over the length of a low, living pine branch, was the strangest thing his gift had ever asked him to carve. A carving knife. For him. Odd. Pine was a soft wood to begin with. How could a knife of pine be used to carve anything? And most interesting of all, it was the first carving he would create by taking wood from a living tree. Despite his misgivings, he carefully pruned the small branch away from its tree, the sticky pine sap befouling his fingers, and then he set to work. It was a simple shape and quickly done, the shavings of wood littering his pants and coat as he worked. The last cuts were to inscribe the symbol of the eternal flame on either side of the wooden blade. He tested the edge with his thumb. It was as sharp as pine could be, but not sharp enough to cut anything firmer than butter. So engrossed had he been in his carving that time had gotten away from him. The sun had fallen farther than he intended, and he wanted to get on the road back to Belshire before full dark descended, so he could camp well ahead of the advancing force. He bagged the newly carved knife and scavenged inside his coat pockets for food. He would eat a little and then journey back to the south with dire news. The army of Cretus would arrive in Belshire in less than 3 days. Davon had half a mind to find Duke Longford in his cell and devour him whole. What greedy foolishness! What insufferable stupidity! Davon put a pine nut between his teeth and bit down, the sharp taste filling his mouth. He rarely ate the seeds, but they were a leftover from his sojourn with the Aua Catan and readily at hand. He opened his bag to fish around for the dried strips of meat they had gifted him. The clean smell of mint wafted out as he scraped a corner, the scent Key and Tar had worn to mask their presence from predators. Davon shook his head at the memory. The campfires below reminded him of the terror birds the sisters had led into the camp to devour the men chasing him. The Aua Catan were a strange people, but their brilliance in the outdoors appealed to him. To know the scents and the smells so well, to learn the ways of the animals so completely, to survive in a place so raw, all inspired his admiration. So stealthy had been Kian Tar that he hadn't noticed their approach in the dark until they poked a spear point in his back. As his teeth worked the tough meat, he glanced below. The dusty, smoky haze and dim light softly veiling the white canvas tents of his enemies. About a mile ahead of the main army, he could make out a solitary campfire, the lead scouts, perhaps. He would pay them a visit before he left. He wished he had the twin sisters' know-how so he could bring a few terror birds with him as well. He stopped chewing. An idea sounded in his mind like a bell on a summer morning, its vibration pushing him to his feet. A smile strained his face. It just might work. He crammed the rest of his jerky back into his bag and cinched it shut. Terror birds might be in short supply, but a surly herd of mammoth? That he could arrange. The plains to the east were full of them this time of year. While a man might not have a chance at driving the beasts where he wished, a gigantic saber cat with a roar like angry thunder would. In an instant he changed to Kodokim and charged off the knoll, weaving in and out of the trees and over boulders with fluid ease. He angled south and east, the scent of the army strengthening and varying with every loping stride forward. Mutton and beef, no doubt plundered from the farms they had passed, stewed in their pots, the dusty leather of their boots, the oil and powder of their guns, the beer in their barrels. All these scents played across his nose, painting a picture of everything around him just as clear as the eyes of the hawks circling about the army for scraps. The camp of the Cretesian scouts waited in a small thicket. The five of them were at their ease, lounging against logs, bare feet to the fire and bread and liquor in hand. Davin searched, snapping slender pine branches as he burst into their camp and let loose a roar that unmanned them all. Jittery legs tried to stand and quivering hands fumbled for weapons, but with a push from his back haunches, Davin soared through the air and killed two with a whistling swipe from his hooked claws. A third had his hand on a rifle. Davin whipped his head and gored him with a curved tooth, chomping down on the head of a fourth just behind him. The fifth ran. Davin was faster. After a brief pursuit, he leaped on the soldier's back and tore his head from his shoulders. Fur and teeth stained red, Davin lifted his head and let loose another roar before loping east with the speed of the wind. Go home, Cretesians. Go home or you'll regret it. Davin hadn't returned. As usual. Ariane massaged her temples as she paced about her new room in the palace. It felt awkward to take Philippa's larger accommodations so soon after her death, so instead Ariane chose an adjacent room meant for distinguished guests. While not as big, it was well appointed. There were separate rooms for her bed and her bath, and a small living area where she now waited for sunset and her appointment in the Flame Cathedral, and for one tardy baron. Curse the man! Could he never show up when he was needed? Nearly 3 days had passed since he had left. He should have returned much sooner. Even if he weren't dead or lost, an entire Cretesian army was making camp scant miles from Belshire. Shots had been fired. Tomorrow would bring more. Tomorrow Cretesians would run in the streets. Tomorrow they would swarm the palace and murder her. The one remaining general in Belshire, a Frederick Marsden, had tried to sound as optimistic as possible. We may yet win the day, he had said over and over. The Cretesians are poorly trained, he would interject. Or perhaps, we have the advantage of fighting in territory we know well. Ariane suspected he simply wouldn't say the straight truth and didn't wish to see a lady cry. She had felt like it all day. Why couldn't Philippa have stayed alive long enough to watch Belshire fall? Why did she have to die and let the ruin of the nation come under the watch of an inexperienced queen barely 3 days into her rule? The only bright spot to the entire affair was the return of Missa and Oriana. The two had waited at Hightower until they were forced to flee southward. They would come to her shortly and prepare her for the ritual at the Flame Cathedral. After that, a long night of planning and hoping and casting prayers into the flame awaited. She tried not to think about what would come with the rising of the sun, though if Davin showed up before then, she might just forgive him. Her lady's maids arrived a few minutes later, Ki and Ta following them into the room. The Aoa Katan sisters had been relentless in their obedience to Davin's command to protect her. Their white hair and icy blue eyes always startled her with their alien beauty. They were, however, nearly insufferable with their comments and questions about everyone and everything, and their unfortunate jerkins. Scandalous. They were excited for the chance to see the Eternal Flame that evening, the first of their kind to visit the Primal Fire in many years. You've been worrying at your hair, Your Grace, Oriana admonished. It's a fright.
I'll fetch the dress, Missa said. It'll have to be one that buttons down the front. You have to face the flame naked, so you'll be undressing and dressing yourself.
At least they have that right, Key commented, throwing herself onto a stuffed leather chair.
Of the two, Key seemed the most fascinated by the customs and luxuries of civilized people.
I was wondering if the primal forces would talk to someone wearing 4, or is it 5, layers of clothing.
Ariane had learned that the twin sisters were air-touched. Key's extraordinary gift of reading the breath of others as fascinating an ability as Davin's living carvings. Primal Air had gifted Tar with the ability to walk with complete silence, something she did to play tricks on the hapless house guard, as much as to do anything useful.
Are you angry that the brown man hasn't returned? Tar asked, leaning on her spear next to her sister.
Yes, Ariane answered, quite angry.
Why do you call him brown man, and not Davin or Kodokim?
Key shrugged.
Because he is brown, nearly as brown as our men, and he is a man. Why do you call him Davin instead of Baron Carver or Lord Ember?
Ariane blushed.
Because we are friends.
So we call him brown man because he is our friend, Tar concluded. Besides, it would be hard to use titles with someone you had to share your body with to warm him.
Ariane stopped.
What?
Tar wore a mischievous smile. Key looked up at her.
It may have been better to keep that between us, Spear Sister.
Keep what?
Ariane demanded. Key sighed.
When the brown man took the test at the Seeing Wall, he returned nearly frozen to death. We placed him beneath many furs, but Tar and I, well, we used our warmth to help revive him.
That didn't sound so bad.
I'm sure it helped, and that it is a common practice among your people. Yes, of course, Tar soothed. We are not as concerned about our nude bodies as you Bitamachians are. Nude? You were all naked.
Ariane was shocked. Oriana stopped brushing and Missa stopped unbuttoning.
Of course, Key answered. It works best flesh to flesh. The skin is where the warmth is. Do not trouble yourself. He was unconscious and remembered nothing. But you remember, Ariane protested.
Of course, Key answered. We saved his life. He owes us a debt.
Ariane thought it best to remain silent. Her flustered, tired thoughts would not be dignified on the other side of her tongue.
Curse that man.
Every woman in the room was grinning except for her. Davin was going to pay for not divulging that little bit of information, right after he paid for not returning when he said he would. So far, she hadn't done so well at carrying out her threats of punishment against him, but this time would be different. A simple white gown affixed and hair repaired, Key, Tar, and 2 of her house guard accompanied her to the Flame Cathedral in the hazy evening light. The Ember Guard patrolled in double their usual numbers. The extinguishing of the Eternal Flame and the murder of Lord Ember had terrified everyone and cast a bad light on those meant to protect the sacred edifice. 4 of the Ember Guard fell in with her retinue as they ascended the steps and passed inside the circular structure. The Ember Guard was just as thick here, patrolling 2 by 2 through the massive outer hallway. Members of the House of Light dotted the hall, bowing as she passed. The sounds of whispers and the scuffling of the guard set Ariane on edge. The entire building felt even more solemn than Queen Philippa's funeral just the day before. It was as if everyone was trying to keep the forthcoming doom of Belshire a secret from everyone else. Ariane scanned the numbers on the doors, looking for number 16 as she had been instructed. Mr. Goodwin and Elaine waited for her there, talking in low tones with Karina, the steward of the Flame Cathedral. She had run the sacred place in Davin's absence.
He should be here.
Tradition dictated that Lord Ember introduce the monarch to the Eternal Flame. Elaine embraced her. Mr. Goodwin bowed, and Ariane was sure he looked younger now. His hair had definitely turned from full grey to black, with only flecks of silver.
Welcome, Your Grace, Karina said, bowing.
She wore the white robe and the golden stole.
I am honoured to have the privilege of introducing you into the chamber of the Eternal Flame. I know you have been here before as a guest, but I must give you some instruction for the ceremony. It is quite simple. You will enter the chamber alone.
She will not, Key said.
It is tradition, Karina argued.
"Lord Ember told us to stay with her at all times," Key countered. "I will not disobey his wish."
Karina's forehead creased.
"What is your will, Your Grace?"
"They can come. Davin instructed them to protect me, as they said."
"Very well. When you enter the chamber, the door will be shut behind you for privacy. You approach the dais. There you will trip the lever, and the eternal flame will descend in its vessel. You disrobe completely and sit cross-legged before it, palms open toward it. If it chooses you, it will do so quickly, branding your palms with the symbol of the eternal flame."
"Has a monarch ever not been chosen?" Ariane asked.
"Oh, yes," Karina answered. "Only about half have been chosen. King Ostris wasn't chosen, nor his predecessor, King Oryk."
Ariane nodded, feeling better. Karina unlocked the door, signalling for her to enter. She stepped in a few paces, Kia and Tar following. Another door waited in front of her, and she opened it as Karina shut the one behind her. A breath of cool air caressed her face as the spacious, dim room opened up before her. A single lamp, hardly bright enough to illuminate a fraction of the room, sat on the dais. High above, in the dark recesses of the ceiling, the eternal flame hung, casting a small pool of light on stonework.
"We will wait here by the door,"
Key said, her eyes reverently joining Tar's in an attempt to see the eternal flame. Ariane nodded and hiked her dress above her ankles. Heart fluttering, she took the sloped path toward the dais. The dark room, vast with empty galleries of seats, felt like a tomb full of ghosts, the air damp and still. She swallowed and stepped up to the circular dais. The beat-up iron lever stuck out of a stone post, and it required both of her hands to pull it back. Somewhere above her, a wheel squeaked, and the pot lowered ponderously from above until it settled with a clink on the stones at her feet. The eternal flame. Beautiful it was, but a bit eerie in the dark. She stepped close to it, transfixed by the tongues of flame soundlessly darting about. The tightness that had clenched her chest for days momentarily loosened its grip, giving enough space for a welcome calm to trickle into her heart. She smiled and removed a strip of paper from where she had tucked it in her bodice. A prayer for Davin. She knelt and slipped it into the fire. While it shed no heat, the eternal flame consumed it without smoke. After contemplating the sacred fire for a few more moments, she stood and undid the buttons on the front of her dress. A drip of water echoed through the chamber, making it seem all the more empty. She checked behind her, comforted by the spear-wielding sisters by the door. Her dress fell to the ground, and she worked at her shift and undergarments. She checked the gallery and behind her to make sure only the sisters were there, though the two of them were grinning and whispering to each other. She blushed, imagining what comments the two rascals might be sharing with each other. Drip, drip, drip. Was it raining somewhere? After casting off the rest of her clothing, she turned her gaze back to the eternal flame and sat cross-legged before it as instructed, extending her palms toward the worn cooking pot that was its home. Drip, drip, drip. She waited. A few moments passed before the tongues of flame seemed to bend forward for a moment as if to smell her, but almost as quickly they retracted, burning naturally as they had before. It wasn't going to choose her. While she had prepared herself for this rejection, her heart sank with disappointment. If nothing else, being flame-touched would have helped the skeptical nobles in her kingdom to accept her as their queen, though, she admitted, it also would have helped her be less skeptical of herself. Drip, drip, drip. Where was it coming from? She stood and pulled her undergarments and shift back on. How she would have liked to have the same discerning gift as Queen Philippa. It would come to little use, she reminded herself. They would probably all be dead in a few days, if not tomorrow. Drip, drip, drip. One of the sisters screamed.